It's you, Barbara.
Stop it.
How will we make it?
Maybe we should. Why don't we just...
What did you see, Clary? What did you see?
I like to remember things my own way.
Remember me.
Reasonably unhinged.
That is correct. We are back. Finally, talking about movies again on a sunny Friday midday. And I am very excited to talk about this movie because it is a request from Noor, who'll be hopefully joining us soon in the studio. But for now, we're just two people here in the studio. I'm Heiner.
Hello, I'm Paul.
And the two of us, we both watched this movie called Hit the Road by Pana Panahi. He is a Iranian filmmaker, so this is very much an Iranian movie. And it did make some waves when it came out. Hello. We have Noor joining us as we speak to talk about her requested movie, which is, as I just mentioned, a very popular movie, a very, well-received movie, a very recent movie, and a kind of unusual pick for Reasonably Unhinged, although I'd argue there is a lot of unhinged material in the interactions this family has over the course of the movie. But I also have a little thing for you to play, because as Sophia has done before, she also watched the movie and sent us her thoughts via audio clip. So we're going to listen to that and react to it.
Hello. I have a bit mixed feelings about the movie. I was very intrigued because it's a quite a new movie, quite new for Reasonably Unhinged. It's from 2021. And I also quite liked the movie poster with the guy who's flying above this green hilly landscape. I really like that. But then there were scenes that I really liked, that I enjoyed, and scenes that I didn't like as much. I thought it was cool that a lot of the film takes place in a car with the family, with the parents and their two sons. When I saw the four of them in the car, I was reminded of car journeys with my family that we did when I was younger, and just talking about and saying weird stuff that only you and your family understand and no one else really gets. I was reminded of that, so I like that. And I thought it was interesting that you didn't know why they were on that car journey in the beginning. I thought that was cool, and it kept me watching. I wanted to know why, where they're going, and what they're up to. And my favorite scene, I'm gonna jump right ahead in the film, but I'm sure you're gonna talk about what it's about in more detail. My favorite scene was the one where the family says goodbye to their older son because of the way it was shot. It's a very wide shot, and the people are like, I don't know, like small dots on your screen. And you see everyone in the family. There's the little boy on one side, and the older son is about to leave the family with this guy who's probably going to take him out of the country. And the mother, she is running back and forth between the also the car is parked on one side where the little boy is as well, and the mother is running back and forth between that and the older son, and it's that was it. And I like that because it was not overly dramatic, because it could have been shot with lots of close-ups of the mother's face or the little boy who is screaming the whole time, but it was a very wide shot, and that didn't make it so dramatic, and you're kind of removed as a spectator from the whole scene, and it's more real, kind of. And you could, I don't know, you could go on interpreting that you're removed as a Western viewer from the film. It doesn't have anything to do with you, their story, what they're going through as a family with one of their sons trying to flee the country. So I really like that choice of how to shoot that scene. What I didn't like as much, there's multiple scenes where you just see the father's face. There's one scene in particular when he's sitting in the car on his own and the camera is on his face and it's a close-up of his face, and that's for like a couple of minutes. You just see how his face changes a bit, and he's not saying anything. You just stare into his eyes and he stares in your eyes. And I think that was supposed to make an impression on you as a viewer, but it didn't, I don't know, it didn't really work with me. I thought it was a bit too much, and in that moment and also in other moments I sometimes found it hard to understand them, what they are going through, what they're feeling, to like understand them their as people, what their motivations are. I found that difficult, but maybe the film also wasn't about that and more about the journey they were on, and maybe you weren't supposed to understand everything they were going through as characters. Also, there was a scene with the father and the older son who's going to leave. They're sitting in the river on stones and eating apples, and you didn't really understand what they were talking about. And also, I think they didn't know really what they were talking about. Yeah, so there were scenes like that I didn't enjoy. But then overall, it's a very important topic, I think. And the filmmaker had some really cool ideas. Yeah.
I agree.
With which part?
The last part, that the filmmaker had a lot of nice ideas.
Okay, cool.
But maybe first let's go a little bit into the background of the film, because it is
But before
unique.
We start this, because okay. Both of you are from really far different culture, how do you perceive the movie?
Your question is how I...
Your feelings.
About the culture?
About the movie.
Ah, okay. I think I would enjoy it more if I had more connections to the culture.
Uh-huh.
So because this problem, which the movie is about, is a little bit, I don't know, fremd.
Foreign.
For me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I need time to recognize what really is the problem, uh-huh, and the goal. And yeah, I think this is maybe this.
Cool. And you, Heiner?
I've seen, like, comparatively a lot of Iranian movies, actually. So it wasn't that surprising of both the mode the people mm-hmm. act in, but also the environment and the way the landscape is used. It all seemed very familiar to me. I mainly watched movies by Abbas Kiarostami, who is sort of the big international hit director from mm-hmm. Iran, who recently passed away, unfortunately. But yeah, you can see the influence. And I, when watching this movie, I was kind of like, I'm doing it wrong, because I did first actually want to watch several movies of the father, who is also an iconic director in his own right. Mm-hmm. So we are talking about a Nepo baby, a person who got his job probably because of his father's influence.
But he's good.
yeah, that's the problem. It's actually a really good piece of work. So the nepotism is maybe justified to a degree.
Cool.
But yeah, it's a unique kind of shift to me from the more restrained, more almost European old school cinema level of slow cinema, where we are keeping a shot for 10 minutes onto a wall and then our character walks through for 1 second. It's much more in line with American sensibilities mm-hmm. than a lot of other Iranian films, which was an interesting blend of kind of, yeah, different sensibilities, I would say. But the movie took its time to get its claws in me. The first half hour or so, I was so on it. It needed its time to get really going. But then when it really, got into it, when the first couple of kind of ingenious comedic set pieces took place, I was all in. And then it kind of managed to build on that and build on that in the last, I don't know, like 20 minutes or so were kind of perfect for me. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool. For me, I'm not a little bit far from the culture and the topic of the movie.
Yes.
Actually, we lived through it. Yeah, but I would say, in the first few minutes, till minute 20, I guess it was not that much clear, but I would say at the minute 60, I stopped the movie and then came back because it was emotionally, mm-hmm. I was emotionally overwhelmed too much.
I understand completely. Yeah. Do you want to speak more on the personal connection you have to the film?
No.
You don't have to, yeah. I get it.
Yeah.
Then maybe let's get a little bit into the background, because I've already alluded to this. Panahi, his father, Jafar Panahi, is one of the biggest directors of Iran. He is in exile. He can't return to mm-hmm. Iran while his son is still making movies in Iran, which is something that boggles my mind. I don't understand how this is possible, because he obviously has to fake his script to even get approval to shoot this movie. And then when it's shot, he's like, haha, I tricked the government. And it's actually a very digressive movie, which sort of goes against the government's wishes. So it won't be playing in Iran, but I still get to play it in international festivals and have a huge hit on my hands, which sort of, it confuses me, because I would assume if this autocratic government was really interested in suppressing this voice, they could. He's living in Iran. They could just pick him up any day. I don't understand why he does, considering that his father had been to prison many times for his movies and is in exile right now.
He was born which year? The son. He was born the son which year?
Oh, no idea. He's very young comparatively for a director, but I think he's maybe in his 30s, I would assume, maybe 40s at the most. But yeah, he has a weird journey on his hands. Mm-hmm. He really...
I'm asking because the Islamic Revolution, they start very strict, but later on,
yeah,
they became
relaxed.
A little bit, that's why they left him inside the country.
Arguably.
And maybe he has a chance, but some people refuse to leave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He says why he won't leave. He says that his connection to the people, I have no choice, so I'm quoting him directly, I have no choice but to make the films in Iran, because I know these people better than I know people anywhere else. We were able to make this in peace. We tried to not make headlines with the film, so they weren't sensitive about it. First you make the film, then you think about the issues that exist for it. So it's, yeah, very impressive and kind of a miracle that it got to be made this way. The two censorship digressions, broken rules that he inflicts in this movie are the open singing of the mother, which is not supposed to be depicted according to Iranian law, and the open showing of her hair from her her veil, which is also not allowed, which are actually the only two
actually, this is strange.
Law breaking.
I don't know if you know a separation movie.
Yes, a separation. Yeah, yes.
In that movie also you can see her hair, but I think there is an issue with that director and the government. That's
yes.
why.
It's the same thing. Yeah, Asghar Farhadi, the director of A Separation, is also in this similar boat as Jafar Pahlavi in constant conflict with the regime.
Yeah.
And yeah, this movie is a much more upbeat sort of endeavor than you would expect from the plot points, because on paper we aren't really told why, but we are left to surmise that it's some kind of religious rule that he has broken. The older brother of the family of four or five, if you count the dog, they journey across Iran to the Turkish border to get the older brother out of Iran in a sort of night and fog operation, you would say. There are interesting motorbiked characters who sort of manage the extraction and taking him over the border, and we are left to surmise that he somehow angered the regime and they are constantly on the lookout. We are given clues like they can't really have a cell phone. The younger brother has a cell phone with him. They use a nice audio cue to show you this with the typical dup, 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 dup sound that we are very familiar with. Or are you familiar with this, actually?
Nokia.
No, I guess not.
Oh, we are very old.
When you have a cell phone close to an audio source, or you at least were used to, the interference that this cell phone's waves make, it manifests in the speakers as this sort of dup, 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 dup sound that we heard. Okay. That's why the parents knew that a cell phone must be in the car.
It was mainly with Nokia phones at that.
I think so. Yeah, maybe.
Nokia phone. Even Nokia phone is not...
I think Motorola too, all those brands that used to exist and don't anymore.
These brands are not anymore.
Yeah. I think Nokia still exists, but they really don't really play a role in the international cell phone market anymore. But anyway, it's... just an example of how much audio-visual language this movie packs into 90 minutes. It's kind of, you see that this is a filmmaker who's doing his first movie, because he seems to be ready to conquer the world. He wants to show you all the things he's thought of all the time during his creative process. And we get a lot of, beautiful little flourishes in this movie. I have another nice little quote to get some more background on Panahi and his situation. Panahi stated his emotional inspiration for the film was the last day he spent with his sister Solnaz before she left Iran due to threats being made against her. Panahi provided a false script to Iranian authorities in order to make the film within the country. So that's really another major part of this. It's a very personal story for him. He said in interviews that he has... many, many friends who went through this journey, who he consulted for the film to find out how to get it the most correct, because he hasn't been on this journey himself, but a lot of people he knows very well have. And I think you can see this authenticity on screen. It's the reason why this movie gets away with being so whimsical and so humorous that, it has a very clear and well-researched point of view and doesn't take this journey and this emotional burden that this this whole situation brings with it lightly. It really manages to have it both ways. It's both extremely heartbreaking and extremely funny, And arguably one of the biggest assets in the film are the three main actors. They, yes. All three of them do an amazing job. They are all very different kinds of people, but they all manage to bounce off each other so well. The father is a very stoic, very removed person whose words are always very few, but then they are often very cutting and very to the point or very humorous in some way. The mother is extremely mercurial. You can see that she's basically breaking down during this journey, that this emotional weight that comes with probably never, or at least for a long time, not seeing your son again. It's sort of dawning on her. She is receiving waves of despair from it. You can almost see her being affected by it so intensely. And then finally, we have the incredible performance by this young little gremlin, goblin, demon kind of actor, a little child who is just incredible, just bounces off the wall any second of the movie, and you are left to wonder, how did the director wrangle this person in the movie? Because probably even off screen, he was constantly jumping up and down and being completely insane. And then finally, we have the elder son, who is sort of an afterthought, really. I felt like he was more of a symbol and more of a weaker kind of link in this narrative. But that's okay, because we have those three to constantly take focus from him. I'm rambling. How did you see these four characters, who are kind of 99% of the movie?
You will start.
Okay. I think also the little boy's like the half of the movie. He is so the one who nearly don't know what is going on, and their parents don't told him, and his brother also not. So, and he is maybe the only guy in this family who is fully healthy and lucky in some way.
He's got a great girlfriend he's looking forward to meeting again.
Okay,
he's on top of the world.
These are his thoughts, so he can lose his girlfriend.
Yeah, he's really pissed.
Yeah, okay, this is maybe his problem.
He wants to keep his cell phone so he can keep in contact so he doesn't lose her.
Yeah, but nevertheless, he is so powerful and, I don't know, so
carefree.
Maybe like a kid would be. So I think also this actor is amazing. So because I know child actors, and they are maybe not like child, or a little bit how the authors think child would be.
Yeah, very cutesy, very performative. This is not at all the case for this child.
Yeah, and I was thinking about, how could the author or regisseur do this nice feeling character? So maybe there is no script, or he could move how he want. I don't know.
I think it's a little bit of both. In interviews, he has said that the casting of this child came about because he was just such a fucking, just a force of nature, just a hurricane in the audition room, just being crazy. And he knew he had to take him on the journey. But it was then also a question of wrangling him on set to get him into different modes, because he was mostly up there in terms of energy. And sometimes he needed to be brought down a little bit.
Yeah,
but it works very, very well, because he is the star of the film, him and the parents. It's a really impressive feat of acting that the director gets out of these three characters, these three actors. And what we are not really mentioning is how goddamn funny this movie is, because it has a lot of Western jokes. Western sensibility, me-coded humor, because they are talking about classics of international cinema. They are talking about Batman. They are talking about the stuff that I like and the stuff that everyone kind of likes. It's also very, referring to the pop culture of the early 2000s a lot, that this child is maybe even a little bit, that like this movie plays takes place maybe 5 to 10 years earlier than when it came out. So I feel like this child, this extremely loud and distracting child, is sort of probably a representation of the director and his vibe, because he stayed in Iran. He is the son of a big film director, and he probably grew up on a lot of movies if he's a director. And yeah, I think that also gave it a lot of emotional resonance and a lot of more authenticity than you would maybe expect.
Yes.
But Noor, I don't want to hog the mic.
No,
maybe.
I want to say the little boy is the reason why I watched the movie. Actually, I didn't know that there is a movie like this. But one of my friends, she put a status of the little boy when, you know, in the last part he was dancing.
The lip syncing.
Exactly. And he, okay, so she pushed me to watch the movie. That's why I was searching
for it. It's a good meme gif, because, yeah, he is so impressive, and it's a close-up of his face as he's
exactly,
lip-syncing.
And they, to be honest, from my previous job as a teacher, I prefer the kind of kids like this, even if they cause some trouble.
Wow.
But, you know, sometimes you need them in the classroom, and it's easy to handle with them, to be honest.
Yeah? How so?
Just
you let them tire out?
No. Just let them know that you love them, and that's it.
Okay. But they will still be distracting the rest of the class, won't they?
But no, you can control them. I one of my students, now he's in year 10. I teached him when he was year 7. It was, oh my God, it was a war between us at the beginning. But, and every time he would say, I'm sorry. And you know, sometimes the parents came and me and my parents were arguing the stuff, and he was just in the corner staring at me and looking at me in a very, you know, a pity way. So, but I prefer these kind of kids. Yeah. I don't like those who are very quiet and shy.
I see. Yeah, it makes sense as a teacher, because at least those loud kids will participate in some way, and they won't just shut themselves off.
But if you push them and you show them support, they will show you good. Mm. They will be good in the classroom. Yeah,
that's nice.
Even in life.
Yeah.
I don't like those who are very shy. Not that I want to say don't like, but, you know, for me, if I will have kids one day, I would prefer to be like that one.
It's easier to handle, probably, because you also want to reach your child.
But
and
because shy,
they won't have to worry about reaching that child, because he's always available. He's always right
Yeah,
there.
Because shy and close kids, it's not easy to get them out of their,
their shell.
Circle. Mm. Yeah. But those who are, the relationship with people are strong. So I wouldn't say I like the character of the kid, because he is very spontaneous.
He is kind of a support person to the parents. It's an interesting dynamic. In the beginning, it feels like he's draining them of energy, and they are constantly unnerved by him. But as it gets to the emotional sort of apex of the story, when we say goodbye to the elder brother, the sort of obliviousness of the younger child, and paired with that, his high energy, managed to sort of distract the parents from the acute sadness that they feel. And it's an interesting sort of dynamic that shifts throughout the film very gradually.
And what is nice is how the two parents, they are not young. I believe they are in their late 40s.
What?
I think so.
Nah,
the parents.
The dad looks like late 50s.
Okay, it's good. So
I'm not sure. I'm going to look it up. You go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
You go ahead.
Yeah. So, but I like the way that they are dealing with, you know, with age difference between the older one and the youngest one.
Yes.
And they giving each one of them what they need.
Yeah.
Although I think
they are very different kids.
I think the dad is more is biased to the youngest one more than the oldest.
Yeah. So yeah. Panthea Panahiha, the actress who plays the mother, is 47, and Hassan Majuni, the father, doesn't have his age as readily available, but it looks like he's born 69, so he would be 8 years older. So he's, yeah, in his 50s. The father is a bit older.
Yeah, and they are how they are dealing with their age differences, and actually you can feel that their family life is very strong.
Yes.
I like it.
Yes, it has to be with that whirlwind of a child in the place. They probably would have broken if they didn't have a strong foundation to support themselves. And the moments of tenderness that we see between husband and wife are very, yeah, very, very well captured. You can really feel that they have a years-long relationship that they are building off of. And the way they talk to each other, the way this movie uses dialogue to show you exactly what kind of relationships these people have and how close they are to each other. The stuff that's not said is huge in this film. A lot of things are being just alluded to. And that's really enough, because we can see from the body language, from the way these two people are talking to each other, that there's a mountain of experience behind them.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, it is cool. I think so.
Even, let's say, the sons are able to say, let's say that the oldest one, when his mom starts singing and acting, she's talking to him. Like, he has the power to say, okay, that's enough.
Yeah,
and I don't know, but in Eastern culture, sometimes you can't stop your parents.
Yeah,
but this is cool. Yeah,
it's funny.
Yeah.
Talking of funny, there are certain set pieces. For the most part, we are just following these five individuals, counting the set and sort of dying dog that they take with themselves. Those are really the people we familiarize ourselves with, and they are almost in sort of an atomic situation in this car. Oh, I also have something interesting on the car. Panahi has stated that cars are sort of a special thing to Iranians. He said to IndieWire in an interview via phone, in a sense, the car becomes a second house for us Iranians. There is a level of security inside the car. That's why you see so many road films. And I do find that fascinating, because his father did the very acclaimed movie Taxi, where he just rode around Tehran and illegally shot a whole movie about people entering his fake taxi. And there is a lot of car tradition in Iranian filmmaking. Abbas Kiarostami's movie Taste of Cherry, where a man drives around the outskirts of Tehran to find a person to bury him after he commits suicide, is one of the big examples of car movies in Iran. The car is an important sort of symbol of, yeah, as he has stated himself, freedom and, having a sense of security from the rest of the country around you. But now I'm losing myself again, because we wanted to go to funny. One of my favorite things in the movie happens very early on, and was maybe the moment I first sort of perked up and was caught by the movie. And that was when a team of cyclists crosses the path of the family. Yeah. And sort of one of the last cyclists in this whole team of cyclists who sort of ride together and seem to be in competition with each other hits the car. And yeah, just basically lays on the ground. The father immediately makes fun of him for crying, which is a recurring theme.
And I think he was lying, the cyclist.
Yeah, he wasn't crying, but he's basically just being an asshole to the cyclist.
And even the conversation with the cyclist in the car was really
perfect.
Armstrong.
Yeah. It's an incredible little set piece, because the cyclist obviously is trying to scam. We get the whole overview of this sort of race that they're having, where everyone's putting in money like a betting pot, and whoever gets to the goal first gets all the money, which is quite a reasonable amount of money that you would want to actually receive. And so his scam is just basically to fake an injury, get taken on a car ride with this family until he's at the top of the race again, and then say, oh, I'm actually fine again now that my house is right next to here, and rides off. And what's another funny decision is that the family, although they probably put two and two together, never actually call it out. They all just basically let him do his little scam with them.
Yeah.
It's a but great.
But the dad was bullying him.
Yeah, I think that that maybe actually felt bad for him on some level. Like, he is like, okay, I'm bullying you right now. You are a little piece of shit who is trying to cheat right now. I wouldn't feel good about myself if I were to call that out too. That's the way I read it, at least. And yeah, it's a nice little pop performance flourish from this bicycle rider who is... I thought also very much probably reminded the two of them of their older brother, because he's also kind of a sensitive, kind of a introverted, and also kind of a dumb guy. That's the interesting thing. The older brother says some of the dumbest, or does some of the dumbest things I've ever seen in movies at some points, but at the same time, he's a very erudite, very academic person, it seems.
Actually, I don't think he is dumb, but since I passed through something similar with me and my brothers, at that moment, you will be dumb because your feelings are suppressed. You need to suppress your feelings or the situation will be...
He's got such a hurricane in his head that he doesn't even understand basic social cues at some points.
Yeah, that's why... Yeah, so he's thinking inside his head, I think, and he doesn't want to hear things related to feelings and don't go and stuff like this.
Yeah,
when his mom, you know, whenever his mom is with him alone, she wants him to stay.
But arguably the most dumb moment is when he's sharing a apple with the father and he basically shuts off. He goes like, I don't know what you're talking about. He basically misunderstands three things in a row and manages to make his father completely irate.
Yeah. Even his dad, let's say, knows that he is dumb because when they, you know, they were in the petrol station, I guess, or they stop. Mm-hmm. For a few minutes when the AC was leaking, the mom was saying that it's only a few years and we will rejoin together and he will buy a big house. Mm-hmm. The father looked at her in a very humorous way.
That's
he will do this? I don't think so.
I actually have the subtitles from English, and it's a great way to put it. He says, okay, but him? Him? it's a really cutting and sort of acidic joke, but it's a well performed joke because you can really feel the shared experience these two had with the son.
But at least they are not sharing it in front of him. It happened with me, with my middle brother. My mom wants him to do something over his abilities. And my dad was just, are you sure you are talking about that one, the similar one? And all of us, we were shocked. And my brother was sitting.
Well, that's kind of trauma inducing, yeah.
Yeah, that's so. It happened. There are stupid moments in every family.
For sure, for sure.
Yeah.
I would share your impression. I also would add, when I know this guy want to flee, I also this guy, so like you, because he is a little bit unskilled in living, maybe.
Yes.
And more in his dreaming thinkings or thoughts.
He's sort of poisoned by media, it seems, like me. He seems to be mostly thinking in movies and
living in a different world.
Exactly.
In a parallel one.
And I think one scene maybe is support this impression, because his mother asked him, what is the best movie?
We are sort of chronologically actually there, so good timing. Yeah,
okay.
I was about to bring that
and,
up.
And he was thinking and say it was 21 Odyssey?
2001, Space 2001. Odyssey.
Yeah.
Arguably the biggest science fiction film of all time. Groundbreaking on many, many levels. I could talk about it for an hour as well.
Yeah, and this was so where I got the impression her world and his words are so different. Maybe because also of the age gap.
Yeah.
but maybe also how they live their life.
Yes.
So, and...
For sure. Also because of their gender difference. He has a lot of more privileges to be in his own world, while she probably grew up in a much more challenging environment.
But I think age difference is more because... I don't know.
Why?
Because you are interested in movies.
When she grew up in the 80s and 70s, she would have been exposed to a lot of great movies. I think 2001, A Space Odyssey, actually is a 70s movie.
No, but my point is, through age, you don't have that much time when you are in your early 20s and you early.
But she had been in her early 20s before.
I mean, that's why you stop watching new movies. When you get older, you don't have that much time.
We don't support this kind of talk here on Reasonably.
No, I'm not saying, but sometimes it happens with me. What I see.
You have less free time.
I belong to the 90s. What I see is sometimes totally different from what my brother 2003 see. Yeah. That's why we have a lot of argument all the time about what we will see, and he's interested in actions and stuff like this.
Hmm.
Even the action I was watching at his age is totally different.
Yeah.
I start feeling this, that the age gap is...
Hmm. I don't know.
Because you are in the field of media, that's why you watch everything.
Yeah, I try to. But I don't want to say that I am a kind of representative of anybody. But in this sense, I would say... depending on the kind of media you are exposed to as a child and as a young teen, that's kind of what sticks its hooks into you. So it could be that you just had a family who constantly exposed you to movies from the 40s and you have a very nostalgic view of that, although you grew up in the 2000s. But it just depends.
It's not about parents. My parents didn't watch movies.
Yeah, well, they kind of can have a hold on you. They can say you aren't allowed to watch it and they only give you stuff to watch.
No.
Yeah, it wasn't the case for me either, but there are a lot of controlling parents out there who are able to exert that
my
kind
parents
of influence.
At my age, we were watching a lot of movies when I was a teenager because I have a lot of free time, and in my 20s, but they never ask. They are not interested in movies, to be honest.
Mine neither.
In music, and even the music I listen to is different from the music they listen to.
It would be weird if...
And all the time they are criticizing our music.
That's a boring take. Yeah, that's a very age-old thing to do, to go like, the stuff that this generation listens
because
to is garbage.
Because the music in my time is very fast in comparison to their the melodies. But, yeah.
Speaking of music... Oh, sorry, Paul, you had something.
I have something like this, so because, of course, my parents and what they saw influences me, but... in two ways. So something I like and something I don't like, maybe because of this. And sometimes I saw something and then I feel different about it and like it. So
yeah.
And I don't like it because maybe my parents watched it or something like this.
It's nostalgia, man. It's very transparent. We are basically just animals who want to go back into the womb.
I think it's interesting because there are some movies I think they are very good and my parents also think they are good, but maybe it's a little bit random.
No, well, they are just crowd pleasers, movies that everybody likes if they just give it a chance.
Or something like this, yes.
But, yeah.
The movies at the parents' era, it was all black and white, and it was all stupid love stories that will never happen in real life, similar to Cinderella, and someone meets someone in the street. And I don't know.
Egyptian films?
Exactly,
yes.
Exactly, yeah.
We've talked about this with the Egyptian movie we discussed here, that there was this kind of... based on American romanticism, this sort of vein of movies being produced in Egypt, and that the movie we watched was sort of a reaction to that, to try to get a more serious kind of filmmaking going. But I want to talk about the music in the film.
You should.
It is a very unique blend. We have a piece by Schubert, classical music, that accompanies a lot of our driving sequences. Mm-hmm. But there is also a whole lot of popular music from Iran being played diegetically in this film. So when they play it on the radio, we are clued into this. We get to see them performing the songs at times and dancing to them. And it's a really weird blend. I'm not sure I really liked the Schubert piano piece that accompanied the movie. It almost had a too somber, too sort of depressive tone for me to accompany a lot of the joy that I experienced in this film. But I really, really love the pop music from Iran in this film, especially the final song. It was sort of my highlight of the music in the film. Well, how did you receive the music in the film?
For me, it was really very nice.
Yeah.
I usually listen to Iranian songs without understanding the words, but the music itself is speaking. Mm-hmm. So I want to say I went back to all the tracks. I think there are 4 tracks in the movie or mm-hmm. 3. I'm not sure. 3 or 4. Yeah. And I want to say the second one and the last one were my favorite.
Yeah. Yeah. The last one is really stuck with me. Maybe we get to play a little bit of it if we have time at the end.
I would say the piano one is a little bit weird and kind of basic in some scenes, but really at the beginning, and you have this piano theme, and you don't know what is happening here. Yes. What is the trouble? It's a little bit weird because you the music sends you in a bad mood, but you don't know why.
A somber mood, a sort of almost depressive
or something like this, and you don't know why should I have this mood.
It makes sense to me. I mean, you can see it in the faces of the parents that there's a lot of gravity happening in the situation.
It was just for
me. Which is not clued into what?
A weird situation.
Yeah, it is a weird situation.
But all the other songs, I think, are great and good. So, good to
Paul, stamp of approval for Iranian pop music.
I think it was good place in the movie, so
yeah,
and
well picked.
And I like this.
Nice.
It's cool that you can listen to music here and Iranian music without being no one will comment, because let's say in the Arab world, if you listen to this, it shows that you support Iran. It means you are from there.
It's a controversial decision to make.
Although I have some Iranian friends, they have nothing with Iran. Yeah.
Of course. It's a big country.
Yeah.
There are a lot of different people. But I have so many more notes, and we only have less than 15 minutes left. So I'm just going to do a quick lightning round of fun things that I liked about this movie. The pee book. It's a great, great thing.
Yeah.
Do you remember the pee book, Paul?
You know, the...
That's where we are clued into how artistic these parents are and how fucking crazy. Because they basically have a whole picture book of every moment that the older brother peed his bed. And they took a picture of the stains on the bed and have a whole, like a family picture book. But instead of family photos, it's just pictures of pee. It's genius. Okay. And they basically joke around that they would be able to sell this to a big European art gallery as sort of a great inspirational piece. And the older brother understandably says, "You assholes, fuck off."
He should.
Yeah, it's very mean and it's very trauma-inducing.
Actually, this seems... Stories
so
like
mean.
This shouldn't be shared. Yeah.
No, it's so incredibly mean. I mean, all three of them basically, take turns punching.
You don't have similar stories with your parents?
That cruel they are never. I mean, it almost crosses the line into where, like, okay, we are meant to believe that these parents are good parents, and they show it in every other aspect, but they're making this pee book. It's insane.
Yeah.
It's very manipulative to a child. Cool. But it's so funny, so I do ignore the fact that it maybe breaks a little bit of the reality of the film. Then the plastic chair dragging in the distance. This was another blink and you miss it kind of moment, because you are not aware that the father has tied the dog to a bright red plastic chair, but you do see a bright red plastic chair hobbling across the distance through a window, and the father is looking at it, and he's completely unfazed. He's like, oh, yeah, okay, this happens every day, I guess. And we as the audience are completely befuddled. What the hell is going on? And then a couple minutes later, we find out he has tied the dog to this chair, and yeah. obviously he's run away, and he doesn't want to be responsible for it. So basically, he just ignores seeing the dog running away. And yeah, it's another one of those visual language feats of the director, which I have to applaud. It's impressive. Then we have the impressive shots of the mountains. We have the fog basically going down from the mountain, obscuring a rider who is a handler for the smugglers. Mm-hmm. And the fog, after he has had his talk, lifts back up across the mountain. And I'm not sure if this was CGI or if they actually managed to get like the perfect shot, but it's either way, if it's CGI, it's very impressively done. You can barely see, or I at least couldn't see how it was being done in CGI. And if it wasn't CGI, it's just an incredible piece of filmmaking and timing to mm-hmm. get this shot so perfectly. There we also have another Batman reference. The child refers to this rider as Scarecrow from The Dark Knight because he has the same kind of potato sack mask on his face.
Yeah.
And that's also one of those moments where I'd lock in and I go like, yeah, this is my kind of dialogue. This is my kind of cultural reference. Then we have a little moment where the kid gets on a bus. And this was also very funny to me, imagining this child basically breaking and jumping across everything in this bus and the driver immediately regretting getting the child on the bus. But at the same time, it also was one of the moments that didn't really make sense to me within the logic of the film, because the parents probably wouldn't give away their child to a foreign bus yeah. driver alone. It's a kind of jump of faith for them, who are otherwise very careful every step they take.
Because they trust the
bus
young,
driver.
No, the young devil.
Yeah, they're basically like, nobody can kill this kid. They can all try, they probably all die.
I would agree, because I was so... in Germany, I would do this. So never to give my child to a foreign bus driver or something like this. And... yeah, it was so...
They are following him, so you can maybe yeah. make the argument yeah. that they're never that far from him. But at the same time, he's a completely unknown person yeah. to them. I don't really get it.
And yeah. and following is difficult, because if the car you follow don't want you to follow...
It's bus. It's a shitty bus. I think yeah. they can follow it.
Yeah, maybe. I was thinking about... how it would be in Germany, and there it's very difficult because you have lights and something like this in the traffic, and I think it's very difficult to follow a car. But
a bus is easier, probably.
But I don't know. And I was thinking about maybe this driver would set out this child in this landscape, because yeah.
Any moment. I was expecting them to be this is enough, child. You are breaking everything in this bus, you need to get out. But no, it seems to be that it was just basically an entertainment moment for the people on the bus to have this little devil entertain them. And then finally, they are reunited. Then I also want to mention the apple scene, because it is so funny to me. It is almost slapstick to a degree, because they misunderstand each other every step of the way. And they overplay a little bit, as I've said, the complete obliviousness of the son. But it's, as you've mentioned, Noor, understandable, because he is sort of in the most pivotal moment of his life. He's gone to be changed forever, and there's a lot of risk involved, so you can understand him not being completely there with his mind. But it is very, very funny. I really laughed a lot in this scene, because the father also has this wonderful sort of, like, he's being unnerved by everything surrounding him. He seems to have the weight of the world on his shoulders, and is so just broken down by all the ailments he has. We haven't even mentioned he has a huge cast on his leg, so he isn't really mobile. He has a toothache, which he's struggling with. So he seems to be just like nonstop bothered by everything around him and not really able to conquer any of it. Just having to live with a lot of inconveniences.
Yeah, cool.
Then finally, I do want to talk about the Batmobile scene because it is, to me, the comedic highlight of the film. I really love the Batmobile. And I love that it got the shout out in this movie. And it is just a perfect image of Batman, the asshole capitalist billionaire, having such an attachment to his $600 million car, as was the estimate by the younger child. And that if it gets a scratch on the road, he would just get out of the car and immediately start tearing up and crying on the road, in the middle of the road.
But yeah. Now you have an idea how much you have to pay for this car.
Yeah, that's maybe the reason why it was so funny, because before this moment, we have a moment where the son basically says, yeah, I crunched some numbers and I looked at some things, did some research, and it turns out if we put everything together, you land around $600 million budget. I can't tell you in Iranian currency, I haven't done the conversion. He's basically going like, I'm in accountant mode. He's doing such funny stuff against his character. It's an incredible performance, as I've said before, but it's also one of the best and sharpest writing in the movie, which sometimes coasts by on its great imagery and its great actors. I think the script is not the strongest part of this movie, but in these moments when it gets to pop culture, when it gets to the intersection between Iranian identity and international media, I think, yeah, you can see that the director speaks from his heart, and mm-hmm. it really touched mm-hmm. me.
Cool. And let's say, for audience who didn't watch Iranian movie, what makes Iranian movie very famous is that they are able to shoot the daily life of Iranian people in details, and you can feel this here, because they can shoot for 10 minutes in the same location. So that's why sometimes it's overwhelming to watch Iranian movie, because they go deep in details and remind you of all the details, maybe similar things, or they make you live the story.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely made me want to watch more Iranian movies, especially those of his father, Jafar Pahlavi, mm-hmm. which are also very political, very critical of the regime. And it also made me want to watch more other Iranian films. The other Kiarostami movie I've watched, My Friend's House, is also mm-hmm. incredible in giving you this kind of slice of everyday life, and have a lot of humor in there and a lot of tenderness and a lot of beautiful visual language. So it is, yeah, still one of the biggest movie countries for me, especially in the Middle East.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. And maybe if you don't have anything else to add,
no,
then we can maybe give the folks a little taste of the music in the movie.
Yeah.
Because I managed to find the movie's closing song. Could you maybe help me out with the pronunciation for the artist?
For the artist?
And for the title.
1 minute, I can't see.
You can't see it? Let me blow it up for you. Can you see?
Shahram, mm-hmm. Shahram Shabbara.
Yeah, and the song is Diyar.
Yeah, the song is Diyar. It means land. Homeland. Yeah,
very
our
fitting.
Country, yeah.
So yeah, let's say goodbye to the nice folks listening to us. Hopefully,
goodbye.
Goodbye.
Have a nice day. Bye.